Welcome to the Convoco podcast. My name is Corinne Flick. It is my pleasure to talk today to Lee Heffrey. Lee Heffrey is a senior lecturer in ethics and leadership at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Let me start with the first question. What characterizes ethical leadership? How important is leadership for a good society?
I think leadership always matters for a good society. Unfortunately, it also matters for a bad society. And I think we'd like to prioritize the first. All leaders act from values. Values are always a function of what people do and why they do it. And that is equally true for those of us who don't have leadership positions and for those who do. The question is whether we agree on what our leaders value or how they value it. We define ethical leadership by consensus, even when we invoke divinity as the final authority. So even in a God-defined world, that presence, that divine presence would set the standard. So we always have to sign off on the values or the ethical code, and the code word here is important, that drives the leader. And our experience certainly recently suggests that some faction of the world's population will always agree with the values that drive leaders who are in positions of power today. The question, I think, for us becomes whether short or long term, where do we come out on that leadership? Do we agree ultimately that the values that drove leader X produced results that we would collectively consider appropriate or inspiring? And the answer is not always yes.
Ethics and morals, right? Could we just define where is the line?
I worried that you were going to take us there. Because it's an important question, and one, as I'm sure you know, people have debated, people being both the layperson and experts and ethicists. For the purposes of this conversation, let's just say that morals or personal values have a kind of private quality that could tie, if we invoke Kant, to those notions, rules and rights, but with an emphasis on absolutes that drive individual behavior, or that we would believe drive individual behavior. Ethics, I think, speaks more to an agreement among us in a community on what qualifies as appropriate behavior. And appropriate doesn't necessarily mean the ultimate right behavior, but the behavior that we agree will support and will justify the trust that we place in our leader, to invoke the context for this conversation, but also for whole groups. So professionals rely on a contract of trust with the public, and that contract of trust depends heavily, in most cases, on a code of ethics. This is what we expect of an attorney. This is what we expect of a doctor, physician. So that distinction, I think, may help here. That is, on the one hand, something that I hold privately, even though my values may align with those of many, many other people. And on the other side, this articulated code that is societally certified. And so when we talk about ethical leadership, the reality is that we do bring a sense of a code to leadership. This is the kind of thing that leaders do, but at least implicitly, we also come to leadership with the expectation that that person, whoever he, she, they are, has standards that we can appreciate. We can look into their eyes and know that we trust them.
Mm-hmm. What can philosophy teach us about leadership?
Philosophy and philosophers supply frameworks. And if you go all the way back to Plato and Aristotle and Confucius, right, at some level, they write what they write or are reported to have said what they said, in the case of Confucius, based on the impulse to help us think about how we organize society. And here I come back to your request for a discussion of the good society in the previous question, right? what qualifies as a good society? How will we get there? And so when the philosophers, and you know, we can run the tradition that I started with our threesome all the way to the present day, all of them talk about leadership in one form or another, but in the context of the good society. And so philosophers provide frameworks. And you know, you think about someone like Machiavelli, right? A philosopher who comes up constantly in debates about ethics. And there's this, you know, an ongoing debate about whether much of what he says in The Prince, he says tongue in cheek. That is, it's so obvious that what I'm saying is problematic that I don't need to say that it's problematic, right? But along the way, he offers us case studies. You know, this leader arrived at his position of power by the following means, and they are not admirable means, but they are effective, right? And so he makes that case, gives us examples, and the same thing is true more generally. I mean, I think it should also be said that the impulse to dictate is always there. That is, I think a lot of philosophers really would like to believe that whatever the rest of the world is doing, they know best. And with that recognition, I think, comes also the recognition that any philosophical argument, while it may claim to be simply an observation of reality, the truth, are in fact arguments. They are strategic statements intended to arrive at a certain end and positing certain things about what it means to be human, about how we organize society in order to get us to the philosopher's ideal state. It is prescription, not just description.
So one could say that where we are today with leadership, it's a conglomerate over the centuries together.
Absolutely.
What role do manners and protocol play for good leadership?
An excellent question. And again, a tough one. There, Václav Havel, in Summer Meditations, as I understand it, a text version of a conversation that Havel had with some of his immediate circle. But in the first chapter titled Politics, Morality, and Civility, he comments on leadership and he says, you know, you don't, as a leader, you don't have to lie. He says, all you need is tact, the proper instincts, and good taste. Right? I mean, that is such a sophisticated, but in some way reassuring statement of what it means to lead. And, you know, yes, tact is a very vague term, but it does suggest very specific behaviors that will vary by individual, but is designed to keep channels of the communication open under any circumstances with just about anyone, recognizing that there might be some basis for a relationship.
Can one learn tact? Not really. Or there are some people who have it and others don't.
You know, unfortunately, you could say the same thing for leadership. And for those of us who teach leadership, we have to believe actually that you can learn leadership, because if we didn't, we'd be out of a job. And so I would say, no, yes, you can learn tact. And it can be a fairly complex process. But the idea that there is an etiquette to leadership and that you can take certain steps to refine your interactions with others, and that's really an extended way of defining tact, I think you can.
Are global ethical standards in a divided world increasingly out of reach?
I am going to post my faith in humanity. I do believe we still have the capacity at least to see the possibility of global ethical standards. We still talk about them. We still have documents, but also ongoing efforts to establish those standards. So the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, admittedly, over what, 75 years old, but it still functions. It is still with us. It is contested. It has been contested from the get-go, but we still have it. And so that's just one example. Sustainable development goals. You know, we have these 17 goals. People know about them. People, organizations are attempting to fulfill them. And I do think that in those attempts, we are embracing the idea of global ethical standards. So your question is absolutely a fair question, but I think we also have evidence that we are, in fact, still attempting to reach those standards. Whether we succeed or not, another question.
Can we teach ethical leadership, or is it difficult to change an adult's moral compass?
At some level, obviously, I've already answered that question when you, you know, so can you teach tact? The same thing applies here. But, you know, this question brings up something that I pretty routinely raise in my classes with the MBAs I teach at MIT Sloan. And that is, what does it mean to have a moral compass? If you take it, if you take the analogy literally, right, what is a compass? You're on a hike, you have a compass, the compass tells you what? The compass indicates magnetic north. And that would be true for anyone who has a compass and is in your group. And if another group 20 miles away also had a compass, they would get the same indication of where the magnetic north lies, right? And so there is a kind of unanimity, a unifying element there. At the same time, you and each of your fellow hikers has his, her, their own angle on that because they are in different spots. And if you've got two different groups or five different groups and they're scattered over 300, 500,000 miles, they would get slightly different readings. So you have both the unanimity and the variety. And so if you apply that and take and say, okay, now let's attach the word moral to the notion of compass, what does that mean? It would seem to answer your earlier question about global ethical standards. That is, we all share some idea of what qualifies as appropriate ethical behavior, even as we come at it from very different places. So the answer, I think, then is if you accept this as a definition of the ground from which we are working, yes, you can teach ethical leadership. It's not that you need to change an adult's moral compass. You need to make that person aware that we share certain things and we at the same time share significant differences, and getting along with one another is about negotiating what is simultaneously a tension between those elements. Individual autonomy and collective security maybe is the word here. And turning that into productive relations. So yes, I think you can. I don't think you're changing the compass. You are simply indicating how much flexibility it gives the compass holder.
Mm-hmm. You have taught many seminars in both in the US and Germany, Italy and Spain, for example, on ethical leadership. Is there a Western leadership model? How important is culture for ethics?
Culture is huge. Especially if you go down the question of where we place the emphasis in ethical discussion. The fact that you may find yourself in a Swiss village or in a small town in southern Texas is going to make a huge difference. And a lot of that difference is culture. I mean, it is also true, and you know, coming back to the Western leadership model that you've invoked, I do wonder whether at this point, for many of us, the notion of Western leadership is deeply bound up with liberalism, or at this point, neoliberalism, because we seem to have arrived there and maybe even to have decided we need to move beyond neoliberalism. You know, for a time, I think we thought we had a system, and Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and the Last Man codified it for us. We seem at this point to have decided that Fukuyama didn't quite get it right, or that he was too hasty in his conclusions. But that moment, I think, helps to define what we mean when we talk about Western leadership. I do think that we're beyond stereotypes. I mean, usually we succeed in moving beyond stereotypes, whatever they may be. And I think we've moved beyond this. So when I talk about our conclusion that neoliberalism has brought any number of ills together with its benefits, that speaks to the fact that we now say, all right, it's time to move on to think about different ways of leading that would not be economy forward. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's also true, and here I come back to your invocation of culture. As you say, I've taught in a lot of different environments, a lot of the different European countries, each of which, as we know, has its own culture. I taught for 10 years, almost every semester in three universities in China for programs from MIT Sloan. And again, this with MBAs, so late 20s to early 30s, so fully formed adults, almost all Chinese, who were eager to understand how the business world worked in the United States and in the West, to use the term that you brought in here more broadly. But they were eager to make that happen, to take their learning and apply it in their environment. There was no, I mean, there may have been individual exceptions, but I never got the sense that they were saying, I'm defecting ideologically to the West. End of story. There was the, so how does this factor into what I know and what I've experienced and what I will be doing going forward? So cultural difference, even as they engaged at some level, and this is true of just about anyone in any seminar I've ever taught, cultural appropriation in the context of cultural stasis. This is what I know. This is what I do. What can I take to enrich the mix of who I am and what I do?
You said we have stepped, or we are stepping beyond neoliberalism. Yes. And you said we have now already new ideas for leadership. Do we know already which directions we want to head, or is it at the moment an open game?
It's an open game in the sense that you never know who's going to come up with something new and different. And we should be open to that. At the same time, it seems to me that a number of challenges of the past, so the first 20 odd years of this century, right, have put up a flag for us. I'm thinking of the downturn of 2007, 2008 and following. The COVID pandemic, I think everything we know about climate change at this point, all of those experiences have indicated we need a much broader global response to challenges because we share those challenges. And so, yes, I think that we are at a place now where we have come up with shifts in our view of how we engage with one another, that the Western model, if indeed liberalism sits at its heart, that there are ways of practicing our economic behavior that need to change in order to enable us to address the challenges that we currently face. So yeah, I think that, you know, whether it's the recognition that the extraction model that we've practiced for so long has finally come to the place where it costs us more than it benefits us. Something like that is pretty clear. And you have thinkers across the spectrum who are talking about the question of a biological model for industry and industrial products. That's a reality. The way we use AI, the degree to which we acknowledge in our construction of AI, and that biology, chemistry as we know it, physics as we know it, all of this bears on what we are doing within our societies, not simply on the outside. The dividing line between us and nature is not what we thought it was, that we are not special. All of that is tied up with liberalism, neoliberalism, and the ways of thinking about that shift have been made explicit.
For a while, many thought that leaders were losing importance in today's increasingly interdependent and institutionalized systems. Have figures like Trump shattered this view? Is democracy more dependent on leadership than we thought?
We haven't had democracy forever, right? I mean, again, this is something that I'm not sure how much history we can invoke here. To the extent that we have always had democracy with us, at least conceptually, I would say that leadership has always factored into democracy. That something is going on here, though, that we have come fully face to face with most recently, and that is leadership in a democracy is multi-party. And the parties are, of course, individuals, one person, one vote in at least one formulation of who runs the show in a democracy. And yes, there is representative democracy, which then generates leader figures who represent groups within the democracy. But the idea that each of us has some say means that the leadership model for a democracy involves the individual. And however many individuals the society comprises, those individuals have a role to play in leadership. And so the reality is education matters. And again, certainly the US model has assumed an educated citizenry. Whether we've delivered on that or not is another question. But there is an expectation for individual actors in a democracy that give them leadership potential. The work that a number of countries have done over the past 5-10 years with citizen assemblies, I think, is a recognition of that, but also the recognition that in some combination, the voice of the people or the voices of individuals who comprise the people have leadership authority and leadership capacity. That is, I think, a recognition that leadership will continue to play a significant role in democracy. There are violations all the time, obviously, of that notion. But at the conceptual level, we recognize the importance of leadership for democracy.
Mm-hmm. What role does leadership play in the wider modern conflict between democracy and authoritarianism?
The conflict seems to me, again, to come back to something we just discussed, and that is the ongoing tension between autonomy and community, between freedom and safety or security, right? And this happens in a lot of different areas of our lives. It's not just politics or it's not just economics. We want both, we being you and I and people generally. We want a sense of autonomy and we want a sense of relatedness. We want to know that we are to see ourselves as competent in whatever sphere we happen to be engaged. And at the same time, we want to have the comfort of knowing that others like us, think like us, support our views, and will look to our well-being in moments when we can't do that ourselves. And so the democracy authoritarianism struggle is simply an institutional magnification of that individual reality. Leadership then becomes a means of clarifying for the individual and for groups or for in society or for the entire society to recognize that tension, which can be a very creative, productive tension, but also destructive. And I think at the moment we're feeling in the face of ongoing armed conflict in many places around the globe that we need some sort of coverage for our own disagreements, some way to resolve them. And even if the assertion of authoritarian rule itself is going to generate conflict and disruption and instability, at least initially, I think the idea is that after a moment of rough transition, we will get to a place where we all feel like we are living in an ordered universe. And I understand that impulse and I sympathize with it, but I also think that we owe it to ourselves to say that's a piece of the puzzle of humanity. Recognize this other piece, and let's try to negotiate a happy balance between them. And that is the role, I would say, the role of leadership.
Yeah, so there is a transformation, or we have to find new roles. Would you call it a global leadership crisis?
I don't think we're any worse off, honestly, than we were 100 years ago, 500 years ago. I think we struggle constantly with what qualifies as good leadership and the good society that a good leader or good leaders would produce. So we're having a tough time at the moment, but I don't think that this is exponentially different than moments in the past. And if it feels like a crisis, it may be because there are environmental factors, and I use the word both literally and figuratively, environmental factors that are keen to amplify our sense of who we are and where we are. And, you know, we haven't talked about social media yet, but I think we can agree with much of the ongoing public debate about technology as we are experiencing it today and the degree to which we are aware collectively in a way that we have never previously been of just how much trouble we are generating for ourselves, and that we are going to need wise leadership to get us to a better place. But again, we have the ability, I hope, to recognize the diversity of interests and ambitions that people have, and at the same time to say, but we have this in common. That's what a leader does. And some, even today, are doing it successfully. And a lot are appealing to common aspects of our ambitions that will end up not serving other members of the same society at all well. And that's what we worry about. Is it substantively different from previous experiences? I don't think so.
Okay, my next question would have been, but you answered it, does being human mean something different in the 21st century? And do we need a new self-understanding in times of climate change and AI? But right. This, you also said that we have it already.
I would say that the sheer numbers we're talking about, so the size of the global population, may make a significant difference in how we see ourselves and how we interact. And with regard to our technology, again, I think that we understand much of what is going on around us in a way that we didn't previously. But I also think that a lot of what we understand qualifies as noise. And if we're looking for the role of a leader in these times, I would say that person has to have the ability, whether acquired or innate, to spot the signal underlying the noise and say, yes, we have social media. Yes, we have artificial intelligence. Yes, we have, right, all of the chatbot magic that we have discovered in just in the past year. But underlying all of that, there is something that continues to mean humanity, and that's what we need to find.
Yeah, I think that's very important what you just said, to find what means being human, what makes humanity. And maybe also to recognize that we need to develop technology which somehow helps humans to be human and not competitors. But is it possible to teach machines ethics in the same way as humans have a moral conscience?
So
we don't know yet.
We don't know yet. It's conceivable. At this point in time, I would say this. The phrase moral conscience, to me at least, implies something with which we are born. So something innate. This could come from a religious point of view. So divinity has imparted to us as individual human beings and as a collective some sense of values, right and wrong, right? And that's what it means to be human. But of course, there's a whole other school of thought about it, and that is that we learn what it means to be human and the difference between right and wrong through time, experience, and inculcation of values from the institutions that make up a society. And here we come back to your question about culture and the importance of culture. If you go with the second version, that is, it's all about experience, then it seems to me it's a pretty short jump to why not? If we can do it to human beings, why shouldn't we be able to do it to these artificial constructs? If you buy the first definition, that is, there's something uniquely human about to use your phrase, a moral conscience, then I find it difficult to imagine anyone successfully sharing that with a machine creation, no matter how gifted our technologists. And the I discovered quite recently that one of the new AI startups, Anthropic, is training its chatbot, Claude, in what the company is calling constitutional artificial intelligence. And they are using the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Apple's Terms of Service as training material for the chatbot. So I think the idea is you use this kind of material, you're going to get more of the response appropriate to invitations for narrative from the machine that would align with our notion of ethical behavior and ultimately ethical leadership. I don't know where the organization is currently with that experiment, since it already goes back six, eight months. But there it is. You know, people are aware of these issues and recognize that there's something that we might do to bring us together.
What worries you most at the moment about leadership? Where do you see the challenges?
I worry about the difficulty of doing what I routinely preach in all of the seminars and courses that I run, and that is to behave ethically, to lead ethically. I think you have to commit to personal standards and organizational standards, because we all operate at least indirectly in multiple organizations. We need to recognize the codes that inform those organizations. And finally, systemics. That is, what is the larger system in which I am operating? And you could use, and again, to rely on terms that we've already introduced into this conversation. Is it capitalism? Is it communism? Is it convivialism? Right? There are lots of isms. And of course, if you go to systems thinkers, they would say, and ultimately what you really need to do is get rid of all paradigms. And so let's stop talking about paradigm shifts. Let's move beyond that to a kind of intellectual freedom that comes with the responsibility then individually to say, I can and will align my personal, so individual standards, my organizational affiliations, and my recognition of the system in which I operate. And on that basis, decide how to move forward or how to help those, to work with those who are part of my community to move forward. That's a huge ask, but I don't think we can expect less either of ourselves, again, whether we are in leadership positions or not, and of the people whom we have chosen to lead us. That's what needs to happen. And I worry that that's a big ask, but I think it's fundamental.
Hopefully not too big. Lee, when did the 21st century begin for you personally?
So it began on September 10th, 2001. My wife, Sandra, and I were at that point co-masters of one of the residential houses at Harvard. So we had about 400 students living in and around us 9 months of the year. In the Harvard system, students spend their first year in the yard, so freshman year in the yard, then they are randomized into one of the 12 houses. And we were running Mather House. We routinely took our rising sophomores, so second years, on an excursion at the beginning of their first year in the house. And we did that in 2001 on September 10th. And we went to a resort area outside of Boston. It was a perfect New England day, sunny, a little cool. Everyone had a terrific time. We really had the sense, or certainly I had the sense, that we were beginning to forge a new community with people who would be with us for several years and who would ideally think back on their time with us as a great time. And that was the end of September 10. And September 11, of course, looked very different. And it's that sort of juxtaposition that for me summarizes where we are in this century so far. And I say that with some regret, but at the same time with some hope, because we did have that day. And I remember it, and I would like to believe others do too.
Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for listening. All the best, Corinne Flick.